This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to the main topic.
The main topic in the margin of a book.
Historian Nathaniel Philbrick is not a stranger to the sea, but surprisingly, one of the main characters of his books, George Washington, was. But his prejudice against the sea, according to Philbrick, did not inhibit Washington's naval genius. Nathaniel Philbrick's third book in a trilogy about the American Revolution was just released. In The Hurricane's Eye, The Genius of George Washington and the Victory at Yorktown follows the first two works of historical nonfiction, Bunker Hill and Valiant Ambition. And Philbrick's deep dive into the American Revolution took as long as the Revolution itself. I recently spoke with Nathaniel Philbrick about George Washington, the hurricanes of 1780, and the war that earned America her freedom. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. In The Hurricane's Eye is the third book in a trilogy, following Bunker Hill and Valiant Ambition. They were published in 2013, 2016, and now 2018, but how long have you been on this deep dive in the American Revolution?
It's a deep dive. I've been working on this since 2010, so this means I've been down this hole for 8 years, and I really just began to realize it this fall, and it means I've been researching and writing about the Revolution for as long as the Revolution took to fight. So it's been a fascinating journey through all sorts of twists and turns I never anticipated, even though we all know the final result. And I think it's just, this is how it all began. This is our genesis story. And for me, it's something that is surprising, but also extraordinarily relevant to where we are today.
You know, that's an interesting perspective to think about how long you've been working on it and how that's how long, you know, the whole revolution took. So that's really interesting. I'm wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about George Washington's naval genius. I mean, you have a great interest in the sea, but, you know, did his naval genius surprise you, given that he only sailed once, a voyage that was misjudged by 500 miles to a destination where he contracted smallpox and ultimately influenced his prejudice against the sea? I mean, were you surprised?
Absolutely. You know, I am a maritime guy. I live on Nantucket Island, and I've been writing about the sea for more than 20 years. But I have to say, even I did not realize what an impact the sea would have on the course of the American Revolution. And I also completely underestimated Washington's understanding of the sea. As you said, he went on one voyage to Barbados. That's the only time he ever ventured on a ship for any significant length of time into the ocean. And it was a voyage from hell as well, and did not enamor him of the sea. But, you know, I refer to Washington's genius in the subtitle. And his kind of genius was not one of extraordinary brilliance as far as, you know, mastery of facts. He wasn't a Hamilton. What he was someone who knew how to prioritize to make the right judgments. He could dial down the static, figure out what was the most important course to follow, and pursue that. And with the entry of the French into this revolution, he realized it was the French Navy he needed. You know, he was not a Navy guy, but he had grown up in the Tidewater. He had grown on the Rappahannock River, ultimately lived on the Potomac. Mount Vernon, interestingly enough, is named for a British admiral. You know, who knew that, you know, the residence that we equate with American freedom was named for a British admiral. And I think in a way it was a forecast of things to come when it came to the ultimate course of the American Revolution.
And I thought it was interesting, you know, how we lived so close to the water, lived on rivers, actually changed the orientation of Mount Vernon to face away from the water. And I found it interesting that he would travel by horse, even when it might be easier by water.
Yeah.
So can you talk to me a little bit about the effect of the hurricanes of 1780 regarding the French preoccupation with the Caribbean?
Yeah. You know, this is where it all began for us. Up until the fall of 1780, the war was in a stalemate. Their battles would be fought, but there would be no real progress in any direction. But that all changed when a series of three hurricanes struck the Caribbean. It would be a start in early October. The middle hurricane, known as the Great Storm of 1780, is now regarded as the most deadliest hurricane in recorded history. 22,000 people would be killed in the Caribbean, 6,000 alone in Barbados, that island that Washington had visited more than 30 years before. And this, needless to say, had a devastating effect on the French and British navies that had spent the last few years fighting it out in the Sugar Islands. You know, we think of the North American colonies as the great gem, the jewel in the crown, but it was the West Islands of the West Indies where the real money was to be made, and that was the priority that both the British and the French had once this war went from a colonial rebellion into a world war with the entry of France and ultimately Spain as their ally. And so after these three hurricanes hit the Caribbean and devastated both navies, the French began to realize, wow, next summer and particularly next fall, we better move a majority of our ships north. Not only will it help the Americans, but the existence of a French navy might very well depend on it. And so this storm, I feel, is the beginning link in the series of events that would ultimately lead a year later to victory at Yorktown.
You know, I was reading about those storms, and at first I thought, oh, this was before we named storms, you know, gave them names prior to their arrival. But then I saw that, you know, one was called the Great Storm and the other one was called Solano's Hurricane. So we named them just after the fact, right?
Yes. You know, we didn't have the forecast potential then, but they were named. And, you know, yes, we have a tendency to think, oh, you know, everything was invented for our benefit, you know, that what we're living through is new. And it's maybe new for us, but it's been going on for a long time. And these hurricanes have been a fact of life down there. And they had a profound effect on American history. And you could argue that American independence, in a way, depended on there being this triple threat of hurricanes a year before the victory that won us our independence.
Now, you write about the misunderstood and often overlooked Battle of the Chesapeake. So no Americans fought in that battle?
Right. You know, we like to think of the narrative of the Revolution as a revolution that was started by citizens farmers at Lexington and Concord, and then with each subsequent battle ultimately led to a fated victory at Yorktown. But the fact of the matter is Yorktown was a fait accompli based on the fact that the French had defeated the British Navy just outside the entrance to the Chesapeake. The British had sailed down from New York with the intention of rescuing Lord Cornwallis, who had ensconced himself at Yorktown at the end of the peninsula formed by the York and James Rivers. And it's an exaggeration, but basically for the first and last time in world history, the French would prevail. Admiral de Grasse would defeat the British Navy, and that forcing Admiral Graves to return to New York to repair his ships. And just as Washington and Rochambeau would arrive from New York with their armies, and thus would begin the siege that resulted in the great victory at Yorktown. And it was this French naval battle, this victory, that made it all happen. And so you could argue we are an independent country because of a naval battle in which not a single American participated. And I think this is an important lesson when it comes to our sense of self-sufficiency in this world.
You know, I agree. I knew nothing about that. And I only recently started exploring the American Revolution. And I will admit that of all of the players, I'm especially naive about George Washington. And I was surprised to learn about Washington's stoicism. Even up to the point when he died, he was taking his own pulse. But then I read that you were surprised about how emotional Washington was during the year of Yorktown. What about him during that year did you find fascinating?
Well, you know, I grew up like everyone with Washington staring at me from the $1 bill, you know, where he looks like the statue on the top of a mountain, immovable and imperturbable. But what was amazing to me was in this year of Yorktown, it's a roller coaster ride. You know, it's Washington is trying to convince the French to help. The French are hiding their cards. And it's and he goes through a wide range of emotions. You see him angry, so angry, you know, the tension ratchets to a point where he and Hamilton, his favorite, most trusted aide, have this violent argument in his headquarters along a stone house near the Hudson River, you know, and they have this argument on the staircase leading up to Washington's second floor office, and Hamilton says, "All right, after all these years, if this is how you're going to treat me, I'm out of here." And this is a side of George Washington most of us don't realize. And then you see when Washington learns that the French fleet has arrived in the Chesapeake, you know, after 3 years of trying, he becomes so elated that he rides back to Chester, Pennsylvania to greet French General Rochambeau and his entourage as they arrive on a boat. And they see a figure on the dock jumping up and down, leaping about, waving his handkerchief and his hat in the air. And they say, "Who could that be? You know, that can't be George Washington, the man who is, you know, the stoic, calm presence. It's Washington." And so it was fascinating to watch him go through this range of emotions. He was a very human, fallible person who had immense levels of self-control, but that didn't mean he did not feel deeply. And I think I came away with a renewed sense of respect that this was an extraordinary human being, by no means a machine, a man who felt every second of this conflict, but maintained the self-control to guide this chaotic situation to its final conclusion.
I read in the epilogue that George Washington traveled to all 13 colonies to create a sense of solidarity in a new nation. And I read elsewhere that you and your wife were planning a similar journey. Or has that already occurred?
It's happening now.
Okay.
I finished these three books about the Revolution, and I'd had enough of bloodshed, and I was getting itchy. I wanted to write something that didn't require 3 years in the archives before I could get at it. I wanted to get out on the road. And I had learned that Washington, as you said, had visited all 13 states during his presidency to help instill a sense of nationhood. And you know, he went as far north as Portsmouth, New Hampshire, as far south as Savannah. So my wife and I and our dog, Dora, have set out, and we are following Washington. It's going to be called Travels with George in Search of Washington's America. And it's been a lot of fun, and we've still got quite a ways to go, but it'll be the next book.
Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked? Because I actually am kicking myself for not following up when you were talking about Washington and how, you know, his sense of calm is what enabled him to prevail, and how the lessons that might be learned by today's military or today's leaders.
Right. Well, you know, I think one of the lessons Washington provides is that, you know, he hung in there for 8 years of intense frustration. And yes, he felt deeply. He was angry. He was sometimes happy, usually angry and frustrated. But he never let those private emotions interfere with the professionalism of his conduct when it came to his interactions with not only his own officers, but the officers of our allies, the French. And, you know, he never burned bridges. He hung in there. And it was his ability to control his emotions, to realize that he needed to hold it together because, as he was saying at one point, "I am operating on the great scale." And ultimately, as he would also say in a letter to Admiral de Grasse, the French commander of the fleet that would win the Battle of the Chesapeake, he would say, "Greatness is our ability to do things not for us, but for others." And I think, you know, this is the model of leadership which won us our independence. And I think it's a model that is as relevant today as it ever was.
Have you listened to the audio of your book?
I've listened to portions of it. Scott Brick is one of the best audiobook readers out there. He's done a number of my books, and it's great to have him once again doing In the Hurricane's Eye.
I looked to see if you read it or if he read it, because I love how accessible you make history. And as I was reading, though, I thought, I wish I had somebody to whisper in my ear how to say this guy's name. I mean, I'm horrible with the names.
Well, absolutely. Well, you know, and particularly with the French name,
yeah.
It's a minefield. But Scott apparently knows French.
Oh, wow.
So he has great fluency. And so, you know, when I was researching this book, I spent a lot of time in the French archives, but I can sort of read French, but not with the level required when it came to reading 18th century letters about French naval battles. And so I enlisted a wonderful translator from Quebec who helped me out. Had to help teach her French naval terminology. But, you know, that was one of the fun challenges of this book. This is truly a multicultural story. And I'm with you when it comes to, I took French in high school, but my pronunciation has always been completely terrible.
My pronunciation of English is terrible.
Yeah. Okay. That's why I'm a writer.
That was Nathaniel Philbrick, author of the book In the Hurricane's Eye, The Genius of George Washington and the Victory at Yorktown, which was published by Viking. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. You can discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torrin Anderson. Our editors are Lou Ann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.